KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
From Alameda, California.
Fruitvale in the Diamond District.
East Palo Alto.
From Oakland, California.
From Alameda, California.
From Oakland, California.
Coming up, Prop A wants to repair San Francisco's seawall in case of a future earthquake.
There could be cracks in the road. There could be collapsing buildings.
Then, we know experiencing racism can affect your emotions, but can it also affect your physical health?
Racial discrimination and racism can impact our health in ways that are not always visible.
And an incarcerated sushi master spills his secrets.
I can make something out of nothing, and you're like, man, what is that? How'd you make them? That's how I did it in prison.
That's how we roll on Cross Currents. Stay with us. First, this news. What's a piece of functioning San Francisco infrastructure that's over 100 years old? The Golden Gate Bridge? The sewer system? Nope, it's the Embarcadero Sea Wall. It's old, it's sinking, and it's structurally unsound, especially if a big earthquake were to hit. That's why the Board of Supervisors unanimously placed Proposition A on the San Francisco ballot. If it passes, it would kickstart repairs. Most local leaders support Prop A, but the few opponents argue that, like many city infrastructure projects, it may go over time and over budget. KALW's Angela Johnston joins me now in studio to tell us more about the first proposition you'll see on your San Francisco ballot. Hi, Angela.
Hi.
So tell us more about the seawall. What exactly is it?
Okay, so I didn't know much about the seawall before I started looking into Prop A. It's actually one of the older pieces of infrastructure in the city. Some pieces were built in 1879.
Oh, wow.
And the seawall is this man-made foundation along a three-mile stretch of the San Francisco Bay shoreline. So it goes from Mission Creek, that's near AT&T Park, to Fisherman's Wharf. And I don't know if you've ever taken a stroll along the Embarcadero. You're walking along the seawall.
That's where it is.
Right. And I want to be clear, a century ago, it wasn't built to hold back water necessarily.
Okay. So tell us about that time. What was it?
Yeah. So to get some history about the seawall, I went there. And I talked to Stephen Reel. He works for the Port of San Francisco. We met at the San Francisco Port headquarters at Pier 1 on the Embarcadero, and we walked outside to the pier. We looked at our surroundings, and most of what we see is built on landfill.
You can see the ferry building. The entire ferry building sits out over the bay. It's actually a forest of timber piles under there, about 5,000 of them.
Really?
Yep. It's pretty amazing construction, 1896.
Wow, that's incredible.
So the seawall that we see is only about 3 to 5 feet of concrete and a railing. That's depending on the tide. But actually, it extends 30 feet under the bay, and it's built on top of a bunch of rocks, which are on top of basically a layer of bay mud.
Okay, so this is man-made. It isn't just where the city naturally ends.
No, and here's what Stephen told me.
So if you look back to the Salesforce Tower, and if you turn your head a little bit, you can see the Transamerica Pyramid. That's the original shoreline. So 1850s, this whole area downtown is a tidal marsh.
The Transamerica Pyramid was the shoreline?
Yeah.
Like, I want to know more.
Well, I'll tell you more. In the 1850s, San Francisco decided it wanted a port. So it dredged a trench through that marsh, and it filled it in with rocks from Telegraph Hill. That was actually one of the original quarries in the city.
Uh-huh.
Roads and sidewalks went on top, and all of this created the port and allowed ships to dock right up against that seawall.
Okay, so what's the state of it now?
Well, Stephen says the seawall has done a pretty good job for 100 years, but it's starting to be very vulnerable to any future earthquakes. And remember, it survived two earthquakes already, 1906 and 1989.
Right.
The port commissioned a study back in 2016, and it had it peer-reviewed by engineers, and it confirmed their suspicions. The fill that was used behind the seawall sits over bay mud, and it's very liquefiable. So in a large earthquake, that's really not stable foundation.
Okay, so what exactly would happen in an earthquake?
Well, I met with Laura Tam. She works at SPUR, the Urban Planning Agency, and she studies water and energy policy.
There could be cracks in the road. There would be again, breaking of the severing of the connection between the piers and the waterfront. There could be collapsing buildings. There could be, I mean, a lot of the things we see could fall over in an earthquake.
But then there's all the things we don't see. Like, for example, the city's main sewer line runs under and near the seawall. And then there's BART that has the Embarcadero BART station. There's electrical wires. There's a lot.
Okay, so back to Proposition A. This is supposed to fix the seawall. So none of this would happen in the first place.
If Prop A passes, $425 million in general obligation bonds would be sold to fund seawall improvements. Mm-hmm. Supporters say it wouldn't increase taxes, and work would begin on the most vulnerable sections of the seawall first. And that could mean injecting concrete deep down. The authors of the proposition hope that future dollars would fund longer-term work on the rest of the seawall.
So who is against the proposition?
Well, there are a lot of groups in favor. If you look in your guide, you'll see a lot of paid arguments from Airbnb and Facebook. BART Board supports it. Save the Bay supports it. The Board of Supervisors unanimously put this on the ballot. Most politicians support it. The only vocal opposition is the Libertarian Party. And Star Child is the main spokesperson for that group. Here's what he had to say against the measure.
The first kind of most obvious one is just the cost of the thing. $425 million, and that's just a start. That's not even the entire project. The entire project is as they say, up to $5 billion. And historically, the estimates tend to be lowball estimates.
He cites other big projects like the Bay Bridge or the Salesforce Transit Center that have gone over budget and also haven't been done correctly. And although the measure won't raise taxes directly, it could raise property taxes over the years, and the party worries that that could get passed on to tenants. They also say it only protects waterfront businesses, and they think the businesses along the waterfront should pay for the fixes themselves rather than people in the Mission or other places in the city.
Okay, anything else we need to be thinking about?
Well, since it's a bond measure, it requires a two-thirds supermajority to pass.
Okay, thanks, Angela.
Thank you.
Angela is KELW's election coordinator and environmental reporter. You can reach her at environment@kelw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Living with regular racial discrimination is a reality for many people. It can affect them psychologically and even lead to depression. And now a new study out of UC Berkeley found that those effects can also be physical. Professor Amani Allen of the School of Public Health studied Black women in the Bay Area and found the more they experienced repeated incidents of racism, the higher their risk of chronic illness like diabetes or high blood pressure. And it's because of something called allostatic load. I talked with Professor Allen to explain.
So allostatic load is an early marker of disease risk and biological aging more generally. One way to think about allostatic load is as a summary measure, a biological indicator that's a summary measure of how well our different biological systems are operating. So let me back up and talk for a second about this term allostasis. So our bodies are comprised of integrated biological systems, meaning that our various systems, our cardiovascular system, our respiratory system, our immune system, our neuroendocrine system, these systems work together for optimal functioning of the entire body. So what I find compelling about this concept of allostasis and allostatic load is that it provides a snapshot of how well our various biological systems are doing. And many of these systems are involved in the body's stress response. So you may recall instances where either you have said or you've heard someone say, "I'm stressed out, my adrenaline is pumping." And when people are saying that, what they're really referring to is the ways in which our body naturally adapts to environmental demands, demands that we're presented with on any given day, being late for work and having to rush to get to work, all kind of family-related stressors, all kinds of stressors.
So if we break this down, if I've had a bad day because I've been discriminated against on the street, at work, wherever, that stress is linked to biology. How, again?
So if, and it could be racial discrimination, it could be any other stressor that you appraise as threatening, and that's key. The way that we appraise the stressors that we come into contact with on a day-to-day basis matters in terms of how our body reacts. So if we are discriminated against and we appraise that experience as threatening to us, then a number of things happen. It can increase the level of inflammation in our bodies, for example. And the key is that that's actually okay in the short term. When that stressor happens over and over and over again, it's that chronic stress that precipitates allostatic load.
Right. And what were some of the things you were finding?
So our main finding was that we did find a link between racial discrimination and allostatic load. However, our findings varied based on the level of educational attainment.
Uh-huh.
So among African American women with lower levels of education, which we defined as having less than or equal to a high school diploma, those women reporting more frequent experiences of racial discrimination had higher levels of allostatic load. However, among women with more than a high school diploma, we found the opposite. African American women with more than a high school diploma who reported more frequent experiences of racial discrimination actually had lower levels of allostatic load, which was very surprising and counterintuitive.
How do you explain that? Why?
Well, one potential explanation is that previous research has shown that identifying or acknowledging racial discrimination can be protective in and of itself versus internalizing those experiences and engaging in self-blame. So if I have an adverse experience, interpersonal experience with a person of a different race, I can choose to say, or I can acknowledge it as racial discrimination and understand that it's due to the prejudicial beliefs or discriminatory actions of someone else and has nothing to do with me. On the other hand, I could also internalize that experience and say that I deserved that, right? That was warranted. That experience, that lack of courtesy was warranted.
What kind of recommendations can come out of your study, and to whom? Who needs to understand this in healthcare, in, I don't know, policymakers? Where do you see this benefiting people?
When we think about race relations, we've seen a lot in the news about police profiling and egregious acts, such as being choked to death on a New York City street or being shot in the back while handcuffed face down at a train station. These are egregious acts of racism and racial discrimination that for some reason in our society, we still debate. But what our study shows, I think, is that in addition to those egregious acts, is that racial discrimination and racism can impact our health in ways that are not always visible. And so often you hear people talk about stress as the silent killer. Well, racial discrimination is one form of stress, but it's a form of stress that African American women report experiencing day in and day out across many different situations in their lives, whether they're at work, whether they're in the grocery store, whether they're in their car on their way somewhere, just experiencing both mild and major forms of racial discrimination, trying to get health care, trying to get housing, etc. And so this kind of just chronic, pervasive, unrelenting experiences of racial discrimination chip away at our ability to just be healthy. They wear us down in ways that compromise our ability to live to our full potential as African American women.
That's Professor Amani Allen of the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley. You can learn more about her study at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now a story from Uncuffed, our series at Solano State Prison in Vacaville. With help from our team, the men there record interviews and edit them into short pieces that we play for you here on KELW.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
In this edition of Uncuffed, producer Damon Cook has a story about making sushi in prison.
I've been entering and winning sushi competitions inside prison for nearly 25 years. So when Keith Kitagawa shows up and beats me on his first try, I knew I had to find out his secrets. One of the things that I learned from Keith is that making sushi is as much about honor as ingredients. But let's back up. I bet you're wondering, how does someone enter a sushi competition in prison anyway? Kitagawa-san, ohayou gozaimasu.
Ohayou.
When you first set eyes on a sushi competition in prison, tell me what it looked like to you. Describe it.
You know, I was at the water fountain one day, looked at the bulletin board and I said, sushi competition. Sign here if you want to sign up. So I signed and I'm like, well, how do they do this? And I thought to myself, how am I going to make sushi? And well, what I did is I had to do a lot of improvising because you don't have the culinary tools that you would have on the streets here in prison. You have to make your own tools. So with that being said, I had to improvise a lot and be really creative. Take a front page of a Title 15 book, roll it up, but then I had to wrap it with saran wrap so I could use that as my mat so the rice wouldn't stick.
What's a Title 15 book?
It's all the rules and regulations of the CDC. So with that being said, I took that book, I rolled it up and got it real soft and bendable. I put the saran wrap on it and made it so it would form with the cover of it. And then that's what I used for my mat, and it worked fine. And then for my cutter, I took you open your can with a P-38. A P-38 is a can opener, a military can opener that they use here in prison. They sell at the canteen. So that's basically what my tools were. You'll have a lid of a can from either a tuna can or something. I took that and I flattened it out and I bent it in half, strained the edge out, and I used that as my cutter to cut the sushi. Making sushi in prison is not like making sushi on the streets.
In prison, you don't have all the ingredients. You have to be real creative. Certain fish that you get here are like albacore, mackerel, salmon. I can make something out of nothing, and you're like, what is that? How'd you make them? That's how I did it in prison.
Right, so we're only limited to the amount of types of fish that we get in here.
Right, and I had the tuna, so I put a little sesame seed oil, some sriracha, a tad bit of mayo. I whipped it up, but then I had the dried cucumbers from the package and the turnips, and I mixed it in with the spicy, and I rolled it. And then that's what you guys taste, what that crunch was in there from the cucumber and the turnip.
Yeah. So here you are, and I'm going to call you a sandbagger right now to your face. You're a sandbagger.
Okay.
Because you entered into a sushi competition in here, made everyone believe you were just a guy, a cat, just coming off the block, right? Definitely Bay Area known sushi chef. Mm-hmm. And you entered a sushi competition with a bunch of amateurs. So it was like shooting fish in a barrel.
You can't learn this at sushi school in Santa Monica, or you can't learn this at the culinary school of Cordon Bleu. You can't learn that. You don't learn that. In prison, you don't have all the ingredients. You have to be real creative. Because I never thought I would see any of this in prison, ever.
All this talent, all these things going on. Tell me how you ended up here, man.
I let my emotions get to me one day. You know, I had a cat get at me a little improper, I would say. You know, and he pushed me to the limits.
Tell me what happened.
Harassing me. For a year inside the restaurant, I felt like he was stalking me.
At the sushi bar?
Yeah. And I would eat it, wouldn't say nothing. He'd just, our dish isn't done, or I'd send it back. Constantly do that. I would say, all right, I'll pay for your meal, whatever you want, just eat it. I'll take care of it. I actually quit my job.
Behind this guy?
Yeah, behind this guy. And then we crossed paths one day. He threatened to kill me.
Wow. Over your sushi?
Yeah, man. Imagine that. You know, one thing led to another, and he kept threatening me. And I told him, hey, you got to stop. You know, it's not necessary.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always talk back to my father about honor and what he would have done. And he always told me, son, defend yourself if you have to. Don't let nobody, you know, take advantage of you. And I felt my life was on. Like, he said he was going to kill me.
Fortunately, the man didn't pass away.
No. I felt I had to make a split-second decision. And that choice cost me 4 years in prison and a lifetime of dishonor with my father.
All that pain, brother. Tell me, man, do you have any regrets?
I hurt my dad. And, you know, I regret that every day that I've been in prison. You know, my dad just had triple bypass surgery. I couldn't be there for him. And that was my promise to my father to honor, you know, to keep my promise to take care of him. And I broke that promise. I never told anybody.
Oh, you
nobody
held
never,
it?
Nobody, you're the first person I really talked to about.
You held that inside?
Yeah,
man?
For years, bro. Never told nobody. My family don't even know. Nobody knows.
What is Keith Kitagawa gonna do when he gets out?
Well, I plan on opening up a food truck and nonprofit for the homeless, Little League baseball, Pop Warner football, and AAU basketball. So I can get back to the community and instill the Kitagawa name. If I could take it all back and erase all the guilt and shame I caused my family, I would in a heartbeat.
Domo arigato, Kitagawa-san.
Dodashimashite.
That piece was produced by Damon Cook. He spoke with sushi chef Keith Kitagawa, and while we couldn't confirm all the details of Keith's story, we can tell you this: Keith was released on parole last week. Uncuffed is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. All content is approved by an information officer. You can listen to more stories from Uncuffed at our website, kalw.org. And that's also where you can and you should subscribe to our podcast. Listen to Cross Currents whenever and wherever you want. Today's team includes Janae Darden, Nina Gensler-Deb, Sarah Coast, Priya Mahadevan, Kristen McCandless, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Porfirio Rangel, Andrew Stelzer, Josh Wilson, and Eli Wirtschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tarek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Two Lazy Boys from Oakland. Catch them at the Octopus Literary Salon in their hometown this Saturday. Show starts at 10 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. I got my Bible.